This is 4:55 on Monday, August 29th. Good morning.
So, and after. A couple of brief housekeeping items. Andrew observed that the errata that are published, that you know that you get to from the textbook website, may not apply to all editions, to all printings of the textbook. If you have something later than the first printing, even though it's still the sixth edition, these may have been fixed, or some of them may have been fixed and others introduced. So just be aware that when you go to look at your book and try to fix these things, you may not see what they say. Second thing is that Matt tried to do the homework on Get Started on homework on Friday and pointed out that the link didn't work. And this was actually a rather interesting case because I've been using the same program to upload the website for about 10 years. And all of a sudden, instead of uploading homework.pdf, I see the link says homework.pdf.html. And this is weird. and so after some investigation, this is actually a bug in the wget program that's distributed by Ubuntu. They changed the version of it and apparently it broke something. So I'm going to have to file a bug report about that. But meanwhile, I spent a good couple hours on Sunday afternoon trying to figure out a workaround, which I did. So so it's an interesting story, but the main point is if you encounter a situation where the link doesn't work, please get in touch with me because I at least need to fix it, and sometimes it turns out to be interesting. So don't be shy about that. Okay, next thing. Oh, escape to get here. Escape to get here? How do you get out of here? You can't go back. Ah, there. All right. Next thing is on the class, on the book's webpage, there are some applets that illustrate some of these concepts that we're going to be talking about today. And depending on how you feel about running Java applets, you may or may not want to explore these. I have a colleague who thinks that Java applets and enabling Java applets in browsers is one of the riskiest things you could do on the internet today. So you may want to explore these or you may not. It's entirely up to you. Okay. Next thing. Did that. Right? Please don't forget to sign in to Qlix. We're not going to do any questions today, so once you've signed in, you won't need it anymore. What we are going to do today is continue talking about the overview of the class and what makes up the internet, what is the structure, and so forth. Yes?
Do you get that we signed in if it's just patched and it says you're already logged in?
It should say that you're already logged in.
Mine did as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine
really?
Yeah. I logged out and logged back in.
That's good.
Hmm.
That happened in 3:55 too, so it's not a new thing.
So it's not a new thing. I thought if I... Oh, I didn't do the thing that I thought I did that would cause that not to happen. So... sorry.
just log out
and log back in. That would be fine.
When I went to the page to do what I was going to do, but I didn't actually do it, which is a button that says force everybody to log out and give me a new list of who's logged in. And I didn't press the button now that I think about it, so there you go. it's just one click is all it takes, but I didn't do it. So we're going to continue talking about the structure of the internet first, and then we're going to move on to talking about delay and loss, throughput, protocol layers, and we'll say a little bit about security. I'm not going to talk about history, but you should read through the slides and read through the book just to get more of a sense of it. I've sort of alluded to it in the exercises that we did with telegraphs and telephones, but I mentioned it along the way, so we won't do that. Okay, so the network core, we talked about the edges last time, the telephones and the hosts and the wires that hook them up. The network core consists of a bunch of equipment called routers. Okay, so that's a technical term, router. The hosts at the edges break up messages, whatever you want to call a message and however long it would be, into little chunks called packets. The packets that we use in the internet typically are on the order of 1,500 bytes or so. Not too big, actually. Although on very high-speed links we may want bigger ones than that. But 1,500 bytes is a kind of standard amount. And then the edge hosts do something called injecting the packet into the network. That it just means sending it, after all. And it will arrive at the first router along the way. It's important to realize that these packets, when you send them, these little chunks, are sent at the full speed of the link. Okay, so if you have a 10 megabit per second link and you have 1,500 bytes, you will squirt it out down that link in how long? How long does it take to send 1,500 bytes on a 10 megabit per second link, ignoring overhead?
Right.
1.5 times 10 to the third divided by 10 to the 7th, right?
So 1.5 times 10 to the minus 4?
1.5 times 10 to the minus 4, which is
0.6.
Somehow I think we're off by one. It said 10 megabits, 15 megabits, 1.5 times 10 to the 7th. Is 1.5 times 10 to the minus 4th is 0.15 milliseconds, right?
Yeah.
0.1, except we made a mistake, because it's bytes, not bits, okay? So, important point here. I led you down the garden path. Sometimes we talk about bytes, and sometimes we talk about bits, and you got to pay attention to which one it is. So it's 8 times that, okay? So 8 times 0.15 is 1.2 milliseconds. Okay? So just be aware, bytes and bits, keep track of which one we're talking about. Okay, L over R seconds, that's what we just did. And it's a store and forward network. We talked about that with telegraphs, right? So the message arrives at the router, and then, and only then, does the router start sending it down the next link. Okay, so if there are two links, it's going to take twice as long for the transmission time, right? It's going to take that amount of time for the first piece and that amount of time for the second piece just to transmit. We haven't said anything about propagation yet, which we'll get to. Okay.
Did you start recording?
I did. Yeah, you can't see that. I can. this version, you can't see that. All right. So the next thing that happens, the next phenomenon we want to talk about, is that what happens if more packets are arriving at a router to go out on a certain link than can be sent? That is, there's more data arriving
than can be sent given the speed of the link. That's where we get into what's called queuing. Right? So the router will have some memory set aside to hold the data that it can't send yet because the link is busy. And what happens if that fills up? Well, then there's no space, and later arriving data has to be dropped. Okay, so this is one source of loss in networks, is that data arrives at routers, there's no space to store them, they get lost. There's actually a phenomenon that has been observed over the last couple of years called dark buffers in the network, and that problem arises because routers actually have too much space to hold these queues. They let the amount of data pile up and pile up and pile up until they have several seconds worth of data to send before they get around to dropping anything. And as we're going to see later when we talk about TCP, it's dropping of data that tells the senders that the network is too busy. So if you don't have any dropping, the senders just happily go on sending data and don't even realize there's anything wrong. So this modern cheap memory has actually caused a problem in the network. The network was really designed to have small buffers, not big ones. And it seems it's a little bit counterintuitive. It seems like more buffers would be better, but more buffers is not necessarily better. Okay, so what happens when a packet arrives at a router? Well, the idea of a router is that it's a place where you have multiple links. Data arrives on one link, and then the router has to choose which outgoing link to use for the data, for the packet. And the way it does that in a packet forwarding network is that a certain field in the incoming packet is the address. We talked about addresses before. Where does things need to be delivered? So the router will look at that field in the incoming packet and look it up in a table that it has called the forwarding table. And you see here it says header value or address 0111. That's the match. So this packet is going to go out on link number 2. Relatively straightforward. The only question is, where does the forwarding table come from? And that's the part of the discussion that we're going to have in chapter 4, I believe it is, when we talk about the net layer. That's the process of the routing algorithms that figure out what should be in the forwarding table so that incoming packets get sent to the right place. Notice that forwarding is something that has to happen very quickly. You have to take a packet, look at its address, see where it's going, and put it out the other side just as fast as you possibly can if you're going to keep up with the incoming traffic. Routing, on the other hand, is a slower process that takes place over a period of time to fill in these tables. And it's the design of the internet protocol that even when these tables maybe are a little bit wrong, the network still works. That's part of the joy of the internet here. Okay, well, we talked about packet switching. We also talked in the introduction about circuit switching, the idea that we set up a path between the source and destination before we ever start sending data. That's called circuit switching. These days in the digital world, circuit switching isn't really circuit switching in the sense of make an electrical circuit between the sender and destination, but rather make a logical circuit. But the point is, it still has to be done ahead of time. Before you can start sending data, you have to have said to all the routers, except they're now called switches, along the way, A here has to say, I want to talk to B, and the network has to go through a process figuring out a path, setting up that path, and only then can we start sending data. The advantage of this is that
once we've set up that circuit, the resources for communication are reserved. Okay? And so if A, sending to B, doesn't use its circuit for a period of time, well, it sits there and it's idle. It's not able to be shared with others. Okay, so as we saw when we talked about telephones, this comes from the tradition of the way the telephone system worked. Questions about this?
Can you have kind of like a bursting reservation, where if you were told, if you told it to use one pipeline and it's filled up, to then utilize the second pipeline, and also allow other data to be using that second pipeline?
Yeah. So in so-called ATM networks, that's one of the kinds of circuits you can set up. It's kind of a hybrid between packet switching and circuit switching. We'll talk about ATM networks when we talk about the network later. Okay. So between it is interesting here that between adjacent hosts anyway, we really do have a reservation of a physical medium. So if we have, say, an optic fiber cable here, an optic fiber cable might have a bandwidth capability of 10 or 100 gigabits per second, and maybe we only want to talk 100 kilobits per second. We don't want to occupy that whole link with our signal. We want it to be shareable in those chunks. And in order to do that, people come up with several clever things as ways to do that. So one way of sharing a physical medium is by sending your signal at a specific frequency. So this is like the AM radio band or the FM radio band, right? You have a tuner that you can tune your radio to a particular station. They're all sharing the same band, but each of them has their own frequency. And by tuning into a specific frequency, you hear a specific station, even though there are many stations broadcasting. And so ignore the TDM one for a second. So, wow, those colors are not very different. Anyway, four different colors. I send purple, you send yellow, he sends green, she sends blue, for example. And we can all share the optical fiber. Same thing can happen on a wired line. You can send different frequencies, although they won't be colors of light, then they'll just be different radio frequencies. So that's called frequency division multiplexing. Another analog of that is like when the orchestra is playing and everybody's playing different notes, you could hear the different notes being played by the different instruments. And that's the same idea. Okay, time division multiplexing, on the other hand, TDM, says that everybody is assigned their own time slot. So we take turns, okay? And so I send for a while, you send for a while, she sends for a while, he sends for a while. And then we do that whole thing over again. Time division multiplexing. There are other kinds of multiplexing that let you use a medium in simultaneously. And one of them is sort of what happens in the classroom when we break up into groups, right? Everybody's talking, a lot of people are talking at once. We can still understand each other. Why is that? Because we have different characteristics of voices for different people, right? And so even though we may be talking sort of at the roughly the same pitch, my voice has a different mixture of pitches in it than Eduardo's or Brian's. And so we can all be talking at once, and people can hear us even so. And that's sort of like something called code division multiplexing, where you send different mixtures of frequency bands or different time mixes. Yeah, okay. So different ways of multiplexing. quite know what the dotted lines mean.
Somebody thought they were important. Okay, so which is better?
Depends.
Usually the right answer to which is better in a complicated situation, no matter what it is often it depends. Right? In this case, it depends. It's a complicated situation. If we have a lot of users who are each sending 100 kilobits per second when they're active, and we use packet switching, then it turns out that we can get up to 35 users using a 1 megabit per second link and not have much interference. If we were doing circuit switching, because they need to send 100 kilobits per second when they're active, we'd have to divide up that 1 megabit per second link and only let 10 users use it. So when there's some randomness in the sending patterns, there's some use and non-use going on. Packet switching often leads to better utilization of the network. On the other hand, where'd it go? On the other hand, when you are sending data continuously, like when you're sending a video stream or a voice call, packet switching is a little bit more than a little bit problematic. And a lot of those problems have been solved well enough to let us do things like Netflix and Hulu and stuff like that, make Skype calls. But sort of theoretically, it's not a great situation. There are lots of tricks going on to make all that work under the covers. So packet switching and continuous data are not necessarily a good mix, but there are other attractions of using the internet that have sort of won out. Okay, so our telegraph and telephone models started out with this idea that we have individuals who want to send data from one person to another. Everybody has their own address. When I want to dial you on the telephone in a circuit switch network, a circuit is set up from my telephone to your telephone. The internet has grown to the point where this idea of doing things at the individual level has just become unworkable. And that happened actually very early on. Instead, what we do is we think about there being networks that are sort of local in scope, local area networks after all, LANs, and that those networks are the things that are connected together by the end. So the network, internet is a network of networks. The things at the edges are often called internet service providers. Here at WSU itself is the internet service provider. And then those internet service providers are themselves connected together, and we're going to see the structure of that here in a second. Okay. So let's see what that looks like. So we've got a whole lot of these internet service providers. How should they be connected? Well, we obviously can't do the n squared thing of connecting them all to one another, right? That's order n squared. We talked about that. That doesn't work. So instead, what happens is the edge networks connect to a more centralized network, right, that itself routes packets from one ISP to another. Of course, if you're going to have one of those, you can have more than one of those, right? If there's competition. But if you've got more than one of those, what have we got now? We've got isolated islands. So the solution to that is add some peering links. So the economics of this thing is that the access net here pays money to the interconnection network for the right to send and receive data, right? So I pay my ISP. The peering links are a little bit problematic in the economics of this, right? Because they involve traffic coming from my customers and traffic coming from his customers. How are we going to work out the economics of this link? Well, that's sort of why it's called peering, because these ISPs actually get together and talk with each other about how much they're going to, how much each of them is going to pay for this link. It comes with a cost. But then we realize that this is going on sufficiently frequently that it would be nice if there were a few places where lots of ISPs could interconnect. Those are called the Internet Exchange Points. And lots of ISPs could get together and have one of those and share in the costs. And maybe we don't want to have just two layers of this, so we could impose regional networks in between. And then there are sort of overlaying all of this, folks like Google and, oh, what are the other ones? Content providers. Akamai, that sort of interact with this whole thing at lots of different levels, right? Because they have so much data to send that they may well want to actually be directly connected to the regional networks and ignore the interior stuff. Very complicated stuff. So it's a network of networks. And, you know, one of the interesting things about the architecture of the internet, the technical architecture, is that regardless of what you do because of the economics of regional ISPs and national ISPs and internet exchange points and access ISPs and local area networks, regardless of what you do because of the economics, the networking piece just sort of works. The packets get from point A to point B as long as everything is interconnected. We don't have to worry very much when we here at WSU want to do lookups at Google. We don't worry about what's going on in between WSU and Google, right? It's just transparent to us. People who pay the bill worry about each of the steps along the way, but the actual using of the network doesn't really have to worry about that. So what does a Tier 1 ISP look like? Sprint, these are some of their backbone wires. Okay, questions about that? I think it's pretty amazing, you know, that you can ignore all that stuff and just sit here at your computer and do all those things, like go off to the website of the book and look up stuff. Okay, let's talk about, come back to loss and delay. So, queuing is the process that occurs, we said, when data arrives faster than it could be sent. And let's think about this. Suppose that I have, ignore host A for a second. Suppose I have host B sending into this router, and that the speed of this link and the speed of this link is the same. Is it possible for a queue to form here? Yes? No? Speed here is the same as the speed here? No way. No, right? Because I need enough space to store one incoming packet. Once I've got it, I'm sort of guaranteed to be able to send it out. Modulo just the different lengths of the packets, but I'm sort of guaranteed to be able to start sending it essentially as soon as it has arrived. Okay, So if I'm going to have queuing, it's going to arise because either this link is faster than this one, or because I have more incoming links here than I have outgoing capacity. How does that happen? Why would you design a router that had that property? Why would you design a router that had more incoming capacity than it had outgoing capacity on this link?
Seems kind of silly, doesn't it? First glance?
To prevent loss of data? To prevent loss of data?
No.
The point is that really a router has lots of outgoing links. And what you do is you sort of design it so that you've got incoming links and you've got outgoing links, and the overall capacity of the outgoing links may be equal to the incoming links, but we don't have any control over the traffic, right? So sometimes both of these may be sending to the same outgoing link, even though sort of on average things for that. That's one thought about it. The other thought about it is, suppose that this is a local area network and this is a wide area network. Well, the local area network has lots more bandwidth capacity than the wide area network does, and somehow we have to share that available space, available rate, and we really can't go as fast as we want to go. And other mechanisms in the internet will cause A and B to slow down in that case so that things don't happen too badly. Okay, so takes a while to transmit a packet. Other packets are queued. And we're going to distinguish between the time it takes the packet at the head of line to be transmitted, that's called the transmission delay, and the time that we sit waiting in the queue not being transmitted. That's called the queuing delay. Overall, there are four components to delay that we talk about. I really don't like this notion, denodal. D per node or something, because we also call nodal processing. So just try to get this straight, even though it's confusing. The total time that it takes a packet to pass through a node, a router, is what? The time it takes to and we'll count from the time that it has fully arrived. So we have the whole packet forwarding. So we've got the whole packet. It takes some amount of time to decide where it's going. And that's called the nodal processing time. Once we know where it's going, we may have to join a queue because we may have to wait our turn. The time we spend there is called the queuing time. Once we get to the head of the line and can start being transmitted, it takes a certain amount of time to actually do the transmission. That's the L over R term in this, the length of the packet ascending rate. And once we have transmitted the packet, it takes a certain amount of time for the packet to propagate over the link. That's the propagation time. And that time is what? The distance over the speed. Okay. So transmission time is length over the rate, the propagation time is distance over the speed. So we can calculate the transmission time and the propagation time very easily. Right? If we have those four numbers, the length of the packet, the rate, sending rate, distance, and the speed. The processing time is typically two or three orders of magnitude smaller than those two. So we would measure these typically in milliseconds. We might measure the processing time in microseconds, two or three orders of magnitude smaller. And so that can often be ignored. And the queuing time is the sort of mystery here. Queuing time depends on how much overload there is of the outgoing link. And so it's not predictable from anything that we've said so far.
So let's take a look. So I don't want to do the caravan analogy. Just look at that on your own. The queuing delay is, as I said, dependent on essentially the utilization of the outgoing link. And to calculate the utilization is expressed as a fraction between 0 and 1, right? Zero utilization means that there's nothing using the link. 1 means that the link is being fully used, 100%. And the terms that go into that are the arrival rate, which is the length of the packets times the average, the bitwise arrival rate is the length of the packet in bits times the number of packets per second, say, on average. Right? So that tells you how many bits per second are arriving. The capacity is that same capital R that we've talked about before. And here's the deal. We can estimate the queuing delay qualitatively, even if we can't get a very good sense of it quantitatively, by looking at this. When the traffic intensity, LA over R, is low, right? There's no traffic jam. There's not going to be anybody in the queue on average. And so the queuing delay will be very small. Clearly, if the arrival rate is larger than the link capacity, what's going to happen? The queue is going to completely fill up, right? Because there's more stuff arriving than can be sent. Okay? So LA over R greater than 1, the delay will become essentially infinite on average. As LA over R sort of goes up toward 1, you might expect that the delay would increase significantly, and indeed it does. So this is kind of an exponential shaped curve. Not even an exponential shaped curve, it's asymptotic to 1, isn't it? Goes to infinity as you approach 1. And what's interesting is that unless the traffic is completely regular, that is, spaced exactly, the same distance between all the packets. Unless it's completely regular, when the traffic intensity is equal to 1, then the queuing delay still goes to infinity at 1. So you can't win, is what I'm saying. You've got to keep the traffic intensity somewhat below the capacity in order to avoid infinite queuing delays. So what do real internet delays and routes look like? Let's see. The traceroute program, I'll just show you traceroute. We'll just do one. Escape from there. Oh, today it didn't do the awful thing that it did last time. So on Unix-y systems, the name of the program is traceroute. On Windows-y systems, it's traceRT. But apart from that, they're very similar. And we can see if we're going to finish in a reasonable amount of time, we want to give the dash n switch dash d switch. On Windows E systems, it's on Linux E systems, it's the dash N switch, but on Windows E systems, it's the dash D switch. All right, so what is this telling us? Can people at the back of the room see this? Not really.
Use the magnifier.
Well, that's interesting. How do I get to the magnifier?
Go to the search bar at the bottom and type in magnifier.
Okay. Turn the magnifier on. It's on. All right. Now we can see it. All right. So, TraceRoute tells us the internet addresses, we haven't talked about what they will look like, of all the steps between us and whatever we say. In this case, google.com. And it tells us, it makes three attempts at each possible distance and tells us what happened. So the first hop took 6.1 and 5 milliseconds, then to go two hops, it took 2.2 and 2 milliseconds. Notice that they're not monotonically increasing. It's kind of weird. Sometimes it's faster to go two hops than one. It's sort of like getting on the airplane and getting an airplane ticket that costs less to go a longer distance than a shorter distance. But generally increasing. Notice that there's something that interesting that happens right here between 7 and 8. This is probably leaving WSU campus at this point. But beyond that, it's sort of hard to tell. 15 milliseconds. These are round-trip times. So 15 milliseconds to get to google.com, wherever that may be. And it took us 15 steps for our packets to get there. We'll look at this. All right, so now, how do you turn it off?
It's just a little outside of your window.
Okay. Yeah.
See, one of my attempts to connect was an asterisk.
Oh, an asterisk means that one did not come back in the amount of time allowed.
Oh, okay.
And that happens because the routers along the way, if busy, may say this is low priority. Don't bother me with that.
Right.
And that's also why sometimes you see those large numbers associated with certain routers, is that they're busy. And then you go to the next one, and if the router is just forwarding the packet, that's a lot easier for it than it is replying to the packet.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Does it ever prioritize by destination?
Yes, that could be done. When we talk about routing, we'll talk about that and why you would do that. There are situations where that is illegal, but it can also be done technically. All right. So if you don't give that dash D switch, it will actually tell you the names associated with each of those hops along the way. But it takes a lot longer when you have a lot of hops with no names, which is what I was seeing the first time I did it without the dash D. So, okay, packet loss occurs when buffers are full. We did that. How fast can you go? Well, you're limited by the smallest pipe. Right? That's the principle here, right? If we have multiple lakes along the way and we want to send data as fast as we can, we will be limited by the rate of
the slowest link.
Pretty straightforward, just like with water and pipes, if you have an intuition about that. And if the first one is smaller and the second one is bigger, then it's the first one is limited, vice versa. Okay, yes. So, bottleneck link, technical term. Makes perfect sense. The bottleneck is the place where things are limited. If we have a fat pipe that's being shared by a lot of other connections, we like, in theory, that they get equal shares, if that's what they want. It turns out that is a algorithmic problem that wasn't solved in the early versions of the internet very well, and as a result, one of these senders, sender receiver pairs, could sort of come to dominate the entire link. Later versions of TCP solved that, and we'll see how that works later on. Okay. Well, I think then we will stop at this point, and next time we will talk about the layers of the protocols as they exist in the network. We talked about protocols before, now we're going to talk about layered protocols. So we'll do that next time. All right, thank you.